Want a recipe for success? Step one, visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. Step two, click on my link to browse OCD Training School's amazing course catalog. Step three, enroll. And step four, enjoy learning. With no added cost to you, you can support the OCD family community while grabbing some continuing education or learning how to bridge yourself to self-help strategies for OCD. Again, that's OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. And use my special link to sign up today.
Hey, OCD family community. The weather outside is frosty, with my hometown getting its first snowfall of, well, fall. But our special guest, Sandy James, is bringing the warmth for part four of our OCRD series to chat about BDD and gender diversity. So join us for an important episode, support, and more hope for our BDD warriors.
I'm Nicole Morris, licensed marriage and family therapist and mental health correspondent. And let me be the first to say, welcome to the family, the OCD family, that is. I am here to create a community of support for family members, spouses, partners, parents, adult children, as there may be adult words, and chosen family of OCD sufferers and their community. I've had over 22 years of experience in the mental health field, but please note that this information does not qualify or substitute as a diagnostic evaluation, therapy, or treatment, and it is presented on an as-is basis. Please follow up with a qualified mental health provider in your area regarding concerns for yourself or loved ones. Thank you for joining us today. Now, let's get started.
Alrighty, fam.
Hello.
I'm seriously bundled up in a sweater with the heat on because it is cold today. In sandy parts of Australia are having, I think I saw the highs near the 80s today. So can we compromise on some weather and maybe meet somewhere in the 60s? Because the 60s are my jam. I really like that weather. Oh, if only that was the way weather worked, right? But welcome back, fam. We have an important episode, and I really enjoyed getting to know our special guest who does such incredible work. So there's lots to discuss, and I'm glad you're here to learn along with us. Also, here in the States, it's Wicked Weekend. So my hubs and I are going to do a date night tonight. I am thrilled. But first, we get to chat all about body dysmorphic disorder for part four of this OC-related disorder series, also known as OCRDs. Say that three times fast. And throughout this episode, you'll hear Sandy reference why BDD is associated or falls under the umbrella of OCRDs. Because when we consider how it functions or how it behaves, there are some big similarities to OCD. But BDD is its own separate disorder family. And it is also important to understand those differences. So today, we're not only chatting about BDD, but we're zooming into the interplay between BDD and gender diversity. Our special guest does a lot of work within gender diverse spaces, and this is actually what led her to treating BDD. You see, she started to notice a trend for her clientele, and while not all gender diverse people have BDD, and not all BDD folks are gender diverse, she did notice a high rate of overlap. So we're going to define BDD. We're going to distinguish how that differs from something like eating disorders, which Sandy also happens to specialize in. And we're going to discuss how BDD uniquely impacts gender diverse individuals. Now, in this episode, because we're tackling an important and nuanced topic, I want to recognize that this is a complex and sensitive subject that often brings about big feelings for people. And so I just want to note that the purpose of this chat isn't to convince you one way or another or preach about gender diversity. That's not my job. But my job is to create a safe space for exploration and for dialogue. And I want to invite anyone willing to listen to join us. Because what I fear does happen in culture today is that when it comes to complex topics, conversations often get reduced to whether people believe in it or not, agree with it or not, where people become more accustomed to shouting at one another than trying to understand. And when that happens, regardless of what we think, we really, really can miss out on some really important challenges, mental health concerns, safety concerns, all sorts of things that can happen, like we're going to discuss when it comes to BDD today. And BDD is a human problem, family. So I'm asking us all to show up for this conversation, for our fellow humans. And if this topic rubs on raw spaces for you, okay. But if you can, please stick with us because our BDD warriors, our families, we're not alone and we're better together. So one more quick note before I tell you all about Sandy, because I try to give a trigger warning when I know we're going to be discussing sensitive material. And when it comes to BDD and a lot of complex mental health disorders, folks can confront a painful level of hopelessness that can lead to suicidal ideation or even attempts. Additionally, within our BDD population, it is not uncommon for sufferers to seek cosmetic procedures or even resort to mutilation in certain circumstances because of the intensity and severity of this disorder. So we will talk about some of these risk factors today. And again, I'm always mindful in giving you that heads up, fam, so you can proceed with discretion. All right. So let me give you the down low on Sandy, and then we'll dive right in. So Sandy is a registered psychologist and certified eating disorder recovery coach from Australia with more than 15 years working in mental health, eating disorder, and addiction treatment. She is a lived experience clinician and has dedicated her career to working with clients that feel let down by current systems of care and treatment approaches. Her primary focus includes mental health and trauma recovery, with a particular focus on co-occurring presentations, including substance use or food and compulsive exercise-related activities. So without further ado, fam, let's meet Sandy. Welcome back to the OCD Family Podcast. And today I am so grateful because our guest today, Sandy James, a registered psychologist and certified eating disorder recovery coach, is joining us from the hours of the morning. And so, Sandy, thank you so much for coming to hang out with the fam today.
It's a pleasure. I'm really happy to be here. It's like tomorrow here.
It is. You're talking to us from the future, Sandy.
I am.
I love it. And today we are continuing in our OCRD series. That's our OC-related disorders. And we are talking all about body dysmorphic disorder. And we will reference that as BDD as well. But I am really excited to have this conversation today because not only are we going to be talking about BDD, but we're going to talk about some specific challenges, supports, and resources, especially when we think about gender diversity and how BDD can interplay there. So I am really excited for this conversation today. But first of all, I wonder, Sandy, if you would tell us, how did you get into working in this area of the field? Because I know you also have a lot of work, as we just talked about, with eating disorder, and I would love to hear more on how you got to working with BDD.
I work a lot with eating disorders particularly, and that kind of grew out of my lived experience. I never intended to be a psychologist. Like, this was not anything I ever pictured. And I was a school teacher back in the day, and I got a scholarship to study psychology because I worked with kids with behavioral and emotional disorders, and I guess they saw something. But the school system didn't work for me, so many reasons. And I ended up working in child and adolescent mental health and then moved to Malaysia and taught in a university over there. And from there, this has just kind of grown. And then during COVID, I had a reoccurrence of my eating disorder and some other things, and had to get support for myself. And through that process, like, I'd been working with eating disorders but at a much lower level, and coming out of COVID, I started to specialize more, and over the last 4 years, it's become my thing, working with long-standing eating disorders and people that are sort of let down by other systems of care, like where they get dumped because they're not making progress or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's become my special niche, I guess.
Yeah.
Which I love. And BDD falls into that. So the crossover with eating disorders and body dysmorphic disorder, there is a lot, like, body image is particularly like one of the factors of an eating disorder, right? But BDD is like next level, and it's also very underdiagnosed. It's very misinterpreted. It's very misunderstood. So that was how this kind of grew. And then as part of the LGBTQ+ community, I started to work. I've worked a few times in the past with clients that are seeking gender reassignment or any type of assistive therapy in gender area. And it's kind of grown out of that because I started to notice a lot of BDD symptoms in that community. And I don't generally work a lot with BDD in the regular population, particularly with parents and gender diverse people with BDD, it shows up quite a lot.
That's so interesting. And there's a lot that we're going to look into and unpack there. And I think it is absolutely, like you said, underdiagnosed. It can be a fellow traveler or get confused sometimes with eating disorder. And so first off, why don't we talk about what is BDD? When we say body dysmorphic disorder, how would you define BDD?
So BDD is different from body image concerns or whatever, because it's like an intense preoccupation with a particular perceived deficit. So something that the individual thinks is wrong with their physical body. And generally it's not restricted, but the focus is on one specific kind of area, maybe two, but it's really narrow. It's, in my opinion, it's more OCD-like than it is body image concerns, because the thoughts are intense, intrusive, all of that kind of stuff. And the level of distress in functioning is just next level. And that's where it often gets, like, people go, oh, you're just like image conscious or whatever. And it's not that. It's 100 times worse than regular people can do. Like, I think everyone looks in the mirror and will pick at flaws, right? Because that's out of our culture, I think, at the moment, with like everyone focused on living forever and staying young and all of that stuff. And this is not that. And it also generally occurs younger. So it'll start late teens or 20s is often when it starts, but it can also develop in older age, the same with everyone.
Yeah. I really like how you emphasize it's this perceived flaw, and it's not just like, I don't like my nose. It would be like, my nose is monstrous. My nose is ghastly. My nose is deformed. My intrusive thoughts around that. And those are just a few examples, you know, it could vary widely. Yeah. And so it is very different.
Also, it's like, I can't go out because my nose is the only thing people are going to see. And they're going to judge you, they're going to whatever.
Right. And like you said, it can have some overlap to eating disorder. But if somebody is coming in for eating disorder, it's generally a more zoomed out picture, first of all, in terms of how one sees themselves. An eating disorder, how would you define it just in a differential way for people listening, maybe going, I get confused when it comes to these two disorders?
Like, body image concerns are like rare. It's more like I'm this label, right? So my butt is too small. Having awareness of that and being kind of obsessed with it and also still being able to help at some level, or using eating behaviors to try and correct it. Where BDD is more like, my butt is horrendous. I can't go out. I can't let anyone see me. So it's very distinct. And body image stuff is, like you said, more zoomed out. So it'll be like my butt and my stomach and room, whatever. And sometimes the body image stuff generally comes from like a sociocultural place where we're told that a certain body is the best, and when ours doesn't match that comparison thing, whereas BDD is not. It's just a perceived flaw, if not based in any comparison necessarily.
One of the things I'm just even thinking about past conversations about BDD where, too, because if you were to sit in a group of people, even other folks with lived experience of BDD, and you were to say, but my nose is horrendous, or my bottom is horrendous, or whatever the thing is, the people around you, they can look at you and objectively be like, you look fine. But it is different. It is different for them looking at their perceived flaw. And so it's a very cruel disorder, as many, I don't think I've ever come across a disorder that I'm like, oh, I'll put up a friendly one. But it's a cruel disorder. And it's really challenging. And then particularly when we think about the intersection of folks that are either gender fluid or maybe trans, non-binary, and it outside of that too, it's not only showing up there, but how the perception, say if it's, you know, your eye shape, and if your eye shape doesn't feel like it reflects your gender identity, in addition to feeling like it's a grotesque eye shape, because again, it's not just a matter of, I'm perceiving a flaw, I'm nitpicking, I don't like this. It's this really disabling, grotesque sometimes is a word that will be used, perception of how they look. And so we want to talk today, and we're going to be talking about this intersection that you've noticed in your work and could speak to that got you more into treating BDD as well, and looking at the intersection with BDD and gender fluid folks. And so in terms of some of the challenges, we're just going to highlight how does BDD complicate the scene for folks, and how can we differentiate that from what might already be more of a struggle and wrestling, maybe with somebody embracing themselves in their own skin?
Yeah, I think the really big difference is that BDD is more OCD-like, so the level of thoughts, like, people can be concerned about cleanliness, right? Which happened a lot during COVID, right? Like, people were pretty obsessed with washing their hands or whatever. But OCD cleanliness is different. And I think that distinction can be very helpful for people to understand as well. But with trans, the crossover between like disordered eating, eating disorders, that can be often correlated with gender dysphoria, which is specific to gender diverse. So I have worked with clients that cannot shower because of that hatred and loathing of a particular body type, right? And the impact of that on the rest of their life is pretty immense. So that's also where people will develop restrictive, right? All eating disorders are restrictive, but start to modify the shape of their body. You remove things like your breasts or whatever, and trying to bring down that sexuality or that body stuff that relates to gender.
Yeah, I actually wasn't looking for this per se, but I get a lot of different mental health themed TikToks or reels or whatever the thing is. And there was a reel of somebody who had just shown their post-op recovery process from having a few different plastic surgery procedures. And it was a trans woman, and she was very pleased with the results. But I remember watching it thinking, I wonder how many folks are going into these, similar in the cisgender population with BDD, going, I need to modify, like surgically modify even my body. I can do things through restrictive eating or exercise or this or that, but it's not going to fundamentally change me. And then what you find is these kind of series of ongoing cosmetic procedures to try and fix something that doesn't feel quite right. And I do believe that this woman was like, I'm happy with the results. That's not what you would hear from somebody with BDD. So I'm not saying that she was dealing with that.
Yeah.
I thought, ooh, I was reading through some of the comments and stuff because I look for those kind of things, those different signals, those risks of people comparing themselves and going, yeah, that's what I need. That's what I need. And for many people with BDD, they go through that process and they're still not pleased with the outcome because it doesn't fix. It doesn't. It's similar to a compulsion like you're talking about in OCD. But then the distress just mounts up in a new way.
And when people do have the surgical procedure to try and correct their perceived flaw, right? Often you'll find people that have repeated procedures because the surgery doesn't shift the perception.
Right.
Or the body part will shift. So it might move to a different body part,
right,
at some point and have to have surgery there.
Right.
Yeah. Pretty intense.
Right. And so I would imagine, again, it would be tricky because, like you said, you've worked with population looking at gender reassignment. And if somebody is struggling with considering, do I need to go through that process and BDD, what part of, like, that has to be quite the tug of war internally.
There's not many safety nets for that either. So if you have gender dysphoria, BDD is often missed. But underdiagnosed, it's misdiagnosed a lot when they both co-occur. So gender dysphoria, when you have the surgery, so if you have gender dysphoria, female to male, and you have top surgery, then that corrects it. And that's probably what you saw in a TikTok video, right? Or a YouTube video. Right? And if someone's got BDD, the surgery, the flaw will still be there.
Right.
because it's not based on the physical characteristic, it's based on the perception of the characteristic. So that's similarly to like the hand wash, it doesn't matter how many times you wash your hands, they're not ever free. So it's that similar level of like, it doesn't matter how many times you have surgery or how much you change your body in whatever strategy you use, it's never enough. So like with muscle dysphoria, it's prevalent a lot in male presenting people, more prevalent in that population. But it doesn't matter how much muscle they get or how much they change that, the disturbance is still there, or it keeps going and going and going. And that's why sometimes like steroids will come in to try and help change that. And it doesn't work.
Yeah, that's a challenge. And I think it's a completely misunderstood challenge, too, I would imagine. And I could be wrong. I'm not an authority on it. I'm just thinking out loud. But what I would imagine is, particularly for people that may already be considering or undergoing gender reassignment already, that's seen in a taboo light in different areas of culture. And so rather than having some safeguards and understanding, it's like, no. We just shut down that conversation. Well, parts of culture shut down that conversation. And so we can see then how a very serious and debilitating mental health disorder like BDD in combination with somebody trying to explore that process and thinking that that'll be the answer, unless it's not, right? Because then they go, it's unfortunately, it's partially them going through the procedure and going, no, that didn't fix it. It's still wrong. And redoing, right? So
yeah,
it's tricky. I don't know where you start working with folks, and I'm going to imagine it's across the spectrum. Some before they've ever gone into any kind of physical alteration to their body or after the fact. But when you see BDD showing up, and just as you were saying, like I started to observe this in my work, where were you finding folks in their process and understanding or helping them understand that there was something more to just feeling the struggle of their gender identity, but also this thing called BDD?
There's kind of not really an answer for that. But most of the time I'll start working with people before at the early phases of their treatment process.
Yeah.
But I will support people to access different levels of gender reassignment. And because before surgery or before the beginning of any treatment, in my experience, it's pretty impossible to identify the difference because both are incredibly distressing. It's only through treatment that you can learn that the BDD is present. And often it's a later stage of treatment. But also keeping in mind that like with gender dysphoria, the surgery can correct that aspect, and then it leaves behind.
Right.
What's left. So it's sort of a process of like working through the diagnosis, because there's also often, like most of the time, there's other co-occurring conditions as well, like social anxiety or major depressive disorder.
Sure.
Often a lot of trauma. I think it's almost not impossible, but it's much, much harder to distinguish the differences. And that just happens through process of getting to know someone and finding out and their trust in me and being able to disclose some of their intrusive thoughts, that when they will say it, it sounds more OCD-like than gender dysphoria.
Right. Because, the journey to self-acceptance, it's going to be categorically different if you're like, I am trying to integrate who is my authentic self versus I am still feeling like a deformed version of myself. I still feel incomplete. I still feel like an eyesore to myself, to others, to whatever the situation. And so being able to sort out some of the differences, like you're saying beforehand, it's a bit too muddied. And so my question too, as you've started to notice this more, then if you are working with somebody pre-surgery, do you think out loud with them about it's possible that this will help bring some resolution for yourself in terms of feeling an integrated sense of self, but it's also possible that BDD could be happening? And I'm noticing in my work with people that there is some of that body dysmorphic disorder. Or how do you broach that with folks as they're going through that process?
I talk to people. I'm really open, really transparent in the work that I do, particularly the population I work with, find it very difficult to trust healthcare professionals. So throwing in treatment trauma, sorry, as example, or medical trauma, it makes transparency essential.
Yeah.
And so as a, when I'm thinking through stuff, I will talk out loud. So I think out loud a lot, and I include them in the process super transparently so that they also understand what my thought processes are. So they don't come up with, like, there's no secrets, there's no nothing like that. So I'll say, like, have you thought about this? Because, like, when people have OCD as opposed to general anxiety, there's a distinct difference in how people think. So it's like a little radar that goes off that goes like, oh, that could be next level. So let's talk about that with
right.
them.
Yeah, generally, I will give like a Y-box, that's the Yale-Brown obsessive-compulsive scale, or an inferential confusion questionnaire, and I will also gauge for OCD that way. I know there are some BDD measures out there, and I don't know I don't know them super well, but are those measures that you would go through as well with them, or how do you gauge for that?
Yeah, I'll include them in the links that I send you. There's some resources that we'll talk about more, like toward the end, that there are some self-assessment tools about, like, could this be something I need to talk to someone more about?
Yeah.
So people can, if they have a concern about themselves or someone else, they can have a look at the resources and be able to distinguish that to some degree and know where to go with that.
Yeah. I wonder too, in terms of people that may be considering transitioning or have transitioned, and certainly can be a primary focus on different body parts that identify with one gender or another, but also with BDD, it's not always, and often not always, just a specific body part in terms of like breasts or penis or vagina. It can be cheekbones. And if we go back and we kind of trace it back, that even beyond gender, that they're probably going to have had hints of this being a problem even before the bigger crisis around gender. And so, like you said, it can shift around. So it could be your hair and that could go to cheekbones. It could be your breasts. It could be your penis. It could be. But generally, I want to say it's generally from the neck up that a lot of these preoccupations and perceived deformities will...
That's more in females, though.
Like, okay.
Females tend to have more focus on their face or breasts or their legs, sometimes their butt, like their backside, whatever you call that. Language is often different between the US and here as well. So
fair.
Sometimes I'm like, oh, is that an Australian term? Or
yeah, you go for it. We'll figure it out.
In men, it's more likely to be penis or that thing that we have here. What's that thing in your neck? Yeah, I've worked with someone that had that as their focus, and they've returned the thing that we can do really about that. And muscle size is a thing as well. There's some sort of distinct differences between what gender identity that you have.
Yeah.
But men can also have it on their breasts when they're bigger than what the norm tells us they should be. So
right.
It can kind of be reversed.
Or even if, again, their norm, right, is in the eye of the beholder. And so if the eye of the beholder is like, oh my gosh, I'm freakish, and somebody else might be like, you look absolutely like, no shame, but average.
Regular, yeah. I had someone that was female to male, and they had gender dysphoria rather than body dysmorphic disorder. But one of the things I said to them, because they still had breasts and that was a particular distressing feature, I took them to the beach one day and was like, okay, so tell me how many men can you see right now that have bigger breasts than you? And that helped them to ease some of that level of distress, which also indicated that it was not be digging, if that makes sense. So sometimes that comparison can be helpful. More often it's harmful.
Yeah. And for anybody listening that's like, well, how? Because if you could resolve, if you could reason an answer that just lets your brain go, okay. Even if it's still a struggle, but you're like, okay, I can integrate that. That's different than in BDD where you would be like, you're lying to me. I got to cover this. I can't go to the beach. Are you kidding? But people see me and, you know, different things to that sort.
Yeah. 100%.
And as Sandy had mentioned before, family, and I'll just sprinkle throughout the episode, any of the resources and information, or if you just want to find out more about Sandy and the fabulous work that she's doing, it's all going to be listed over on this episode's blog at OCDFamilyPodcast.com. So I will link you up because I know how we listen to podcasts. Some of us might be at the beach, and that's totally fair. So this is kind of an interesting question because having worked and served people, well, really between Australia and then also in Malaysia, did you notice some cultural differences too in terms of how people were experiencing this and some of the added challenges or what areas may have had more supports? What did you see and find to be the difference there? Because I'm sure that there are some major cultural differences in terms of even how gender is perceived, let alone how BDD.
100%.
Yeah.
In Australia, only in, I think, 2017 made same-sex marriage legal. So that's super recently, right? Like it wasn't very long ago.
Right. And 7 years.
Yeah. Because I got married 2 years after that.
Mm-hmm.
I think, although I've been with my partner for like 157 years, really.
Right. So it's hard to tell. You're like, we've been together forever. Yeah.
Yeah. But Australia has a lot more resources and a lot more capacity to identify differences, gender presentation, what gender identity, or any of that stuff. And also increasing awareness of OCD characteristics and behaviors. Not as aware, I guess, as the state, which has a lot of resources and also like a lot more resources to be able to put in to research and studies and things like that. Australia's a little bit limited in some areas with that. But Malaysia is a whole different thing. Like being LGBTQ plus in Malaysia is illegal still.
Right.
So you can be put in prison if you're gay. But those challenges in and of itself, so if you have gender dysphoria or gender identity difficulty, then there's no release, really not any resources over there. And as much as it's starting to develop, the people that are working in that area will often get ostracized and threatened and almost cancelled to some extent. And it becomes incredibly challenging. When I was working there, eating disorders were not recognized. I think I was one of the first people to start talking about that over there and to identify it and treat it specifically. And I think that the population in Malaysia is diverse, and their religious culture is also pretty diverse in different parts. I worked in a place where it was a lot more open to things. The gender stuff is still ostracized. That doesn't matter much. But in some of the indigenous cultures in Borneo, there are 2-7 gender identities that are recognized and named. So there are pockets where that I can't remember the name of the people anymore, but you can find that there's information about it on the interwebs, you know.
Yeah.
So there are differences. Also, there's no way to have any surgery. You have to travel internationally if you want to have a surgery. I actually had someone recently that was able to have top surgery in Malaysia, but it had to be framed for medical reasons. So the gender stuff had to be taken out of the conversation. There were other reasons that were identified, but the surgery was important. But the level of surgery was more difficult for them to do because they didn't want to take it all off. They wanted to reduce, and that was not going to make that person's really heaps more complicated.
Yeah. So safety just in general, in terms of just living, take BDD out of it with any difficult mental health, and it's not an equal playing field across the world and across different countries, even within certain countries, depending on, like you said, what pockets you're in or not, your ability to feel safe. And I would imagine too, because what we see for BDD, and again, whether we're talking about in the LGBTQ community or cisgender community, is that sometimes if people don't feel like they have access to treatments that they need, that they require, it can result in them taking things into their own hands. So we can have some mutilation situations, or, you know, in the just most tragic, it's all tragic, but most tragic of circumstances, even in suicide or taking their own life, because they can't live with this version of reality and what's going on. And so those are real risk factors on top of just the safety risk factor. If you're a person that identifies in the community, gender reassignment aside, BDD aside, that could present a safety issue. Mm-hmm. And then on top of it, if you're feeling that desperation and I can't go and actually get a procedure and access a procedure, then you're going to have people that in desperation are driven to try and remedy that for themselves. So I'm sure you've come across that too in your work.
Yeah, it can get really dangerous. And Thailand is close and rush for people to be able to go to Thai room for particular surgeries and stuff. But you still can't change your identification at all in Malaysia. So you can do that different thing and look different if that's like if it's a gender dysphoria. But also, like, you have to have access to resources to, okay, to do it. You have to be able to pay for stuff. And mental health care in Southeast Asia is questionable, to say the least. And I love it over there. If I could live back in Borneo, where I was, I would be there in a flash. I love the way working over there, the impact can be exponential. There's really not a comparison. In saying that, also, I'm loving what I'm doing here, but yeah, it's not the whole location. There are people over there doing some incredible work and trying to make change. Part of what I really to be able to do is support those people. And I still work with quite a few people in Malaysia and collaborate with some medical professionals over there and try to make things a little bit different.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that brings up a good point too, because I know one of the things BDD advocates here in the States and treatment practitioners have tried to do is even like partnering with dermatologists or partnering with plastic surgeons and going, hey, can we screen for this thing? This is problematic. Mm-hmm. It can be a conflict of interest because, of course, doctors are going to want to be able to do their surgeries and not necessarily and can benefit.
Like their money.
Right. They like their money. But also, like you're saying, if you're in an area where partnering with a doctor and it's illegal to even consider a difference, how dare you partner with area doctors or say, hey, can we do a screener or help with that? Because it's not regarded in the same way.
Also, the language difficulties, there's a whole process that we go through to validate screening tools, right? And if the people, like, English is a second language for most people in that part of the world, and how do you validate a tool that is not even recognized in the first place? It's just like, and levels go right through from like research up to practice.
Yeah.
Those baby steps where, when it's possible, like with the people that are willing to do it, then we can introduce some of the tools. And doctors have to be able to speak English over there. So we can get translators and stuff to help with some of those more complicated features, but then they're still not recognized as valid assessments, if that makes sense.
It does. So there are a lot of different challenges. And we happen to be talking in Australia, we're talking about in Southeast Asia, but we run into these challenges in the States and in the West. And it's a relevant issue that I think sometimes when the conversation around gender identity comes up, people get real zoomed into certain talking points and they miss a lot of what's going on here, kind of some of these nuances and the fringe that can exist. We know mental health is going to impact people, but particularly too, when we're thinking about BDD and just the different risk factors that can impact people. And so with that, I know that fam listening might be like, oh, this feels heavy. It's heavy. And it is, right? Yes, Sandy and I, Jinx, we were like on it with the heavy. Guess what? There's still treatment opportunities and hope. And every now and then, I'm sure for so many people in Malaysia, they were like, Sandy came along and it does make such an exponential difference. And so in terms of bringing hope and therapeutic approaches that can help lead to some healing, particularly when we're thinking about BDD and maybe realizing after the fact that it's not always going to be that somebody's gone through a transition, but we're going to find BDD along the way. What kind of hope factors and treatment courses have you found to be particularly helpful on this journey?
there's quite a few options. I think usually where I'll start, because I think also the language that's used with BDD, like internally, is a lot more emotive. And so there's different pathways to treatment. Medication can be really, really helpful to be able to take the pointy end off the thoughts. And I think also because of the co-occurring condition coding at the same time. So if you can treat one with medication, that will make the treatment of another less complicated. And that's the case with every co-occurring condition, right? If you can decrease one, then you have a better chance of decreasing the other, and but doing them consecutively. So you have to work with everything at the same time, which I know gets really difficult. Some of the treatment modalities that are really helpful are things like acceptance and commitment therapy.
Mm-hmm.
ERP can be really helpful. I will often do ERP in combination with other approaches to reduce the severity. So like, as it would be standard, right? Like, let's work out how we can get through this.
Yeah. Well, in ERP, for anybody listening that's like, what is ERP? It's exposure and response prevention. And it's doing some really good psychoeducation about how those thoughts are functioning, how the response is, you know, whether it's the avoidance, I can't go out, or certain procedures, creams, things that are going to make this maybe part of you that, again, this perceived flaw that feels so garish, so ugly, so deformed, it's going to change this somehow. Going to a dermatologist, getting creams, beauty creams, this, that, it can get dangerous in terms of bleaching and different things that people will do to try and change.
And the financial impact, right?
Yes. And there's a huge financial impact. It's not cheap, y'all. It's not free, right? And so looking at those different pieces and looking at how the intrusive nature of those thoughts and those actions or even mental acts in terms of trying to cope with it are impacting, and then really starting to expose yourself within parameters, within safety limits and in value-driven ways, expose yourself to the parameters. So even I would imagine going to the beach and saying what men have larger or smaller breasts could be in the framework of an ERP exposure. You would build a hierarchy, you would expose yourself, and you would practice the response prevention, which is the creme de la creme, in that if you don't do the same response avoidance and doing all the creams and the things that can help change really what the brain learns. And so, and that can bring some distress reduction. It can bring freedom in terms of feeling kind of trapped to that particular thought process, et cetera. And so you would do some ERP along with that. Did you do, I feel like I've heard this and I'm not even sure exactly what it is, but do you do mirror work?
No, it can be part of the exposure hierarchy. Yeah, I'm not a big fan of using the mirror. It also kind of goes back to in the early phases of treatment, I will recommend people actually cover up mirrors and I'm trying to avoid them, which is impossible because glass acts like a mirror a lot of the time. But if you can reduce the amount focusing on the particular flaw, I also think like it translates as well, like another metaphor is like what you pay attention to is what you see, right? So I think about when I bought a car that I thought was so special, and as soon as I bought it, there were hundreds of them, right? And that was mind-blowing. The meaning that when I looked out, not just in that one particular area, then I started to notice that other people had the same car, right? So that idea of being able to notice, sort of moving your perception from internal to more external, and that can also help reduce some of the distress.
It also depends on how that mirror is functioning for you. And a lot of people use it in a compulsive manner. When it comes to, you know, it can be OCD, it could be ADD, different things like that. And I've heard of like mirror training or mirror work or something, but I don't specialize in that. So I was like, I'm not sure if that's a part of the treatment course, and maybe it can be, but.
I remember when I was in treatment once, I've got a history of substance use and all sorts of stuff, but I remember in one treatment episode, they said to me, I want you to look in the mirror, look yourself in the eyes and say these affirmations. And I was like, no fucking way. You're like, that's just dumbass bullshit. And the way I work is I would never suggest someone do that because it was such an adverse reaction in me. And I think that affirmations, they can help shift. I tend to do them in different ways because affirmations in my head, they'll just set up a big argument with myself. But then I end up getting into a debate about, like, I'll say, oh, you're a beautiful human being or whatever. And then it'll be like, no, but what about this, this, this? And then I end up just being, you know, I tend to use strategies that I've found helpful because I find that, like, there, then I can talk to them in a different way. Whereas, like, I'm not going to sell a product that I think is less effective.
Yeah. Yeah. Fair.
Trying to say that in a politically correct way, but not to bag out any other treatment modalities. But if someone, if I'm working with someone and the way I'm working doesn't work for them, then I will help them find someone who works in a way that works for them.
Yeah.
Right. So that kind of idea. So I'm not good for everyone.
Right. Well, and none of us are perfect. So isn't that a relief that we don't have to be?
Back to the mirror kind of idea. Being able to use the mirror in a way that's effective, right? So we use a mirror to put makeup on or brush our hair or whatever, rather than that compulsive checking to make sure that the floor is still there, right?
Right. Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. And so in terms of treatment, do you do any family therapy or anything like that as a support? Or how does the loved ones surrounding the person struggling with BDD come around and learn about A, what's happening to their loved one, and B, how they can support them through that treatment process?
I don't do family therapy in the true sense of the term. I do a lot of psychoed. And there are resources that I'll give you as well for family members, friends, and loved ones also. So there are resources out there and there are networks like support groups, peer support groups, and things like that, that families can access to get tips from people that are living the same thing. And I think that's often more helpful than talking to me about it. Like, I'll give the psychoed, I'll give the information, I'll give maybe some tips about more what not to do rather than what to do. And we learn what to do over time, and we learn that through experience, and we learn that through talking to other people that have been there, right? Because I don't have all the answers and I don't know what's actually going to work for that particular family or person.
Yeah.
And we explore that together. So I walk, like, I will say to clients all the time, like, I'm walking beside you. I'm not leading the way. Like, I will offer tips and tricks, and we do experiments to try and find out, okay, what's going to work? And if something doesn't work, it doesn't mean we've failed. It means that that's not the right tool for you. And we will find other tools to replace it rather than blaming the individual, which often happens in treatment as well. It's like, if this doesn't work, it's your fault. It's not like, if this doesn't work, then it's not the right treatment for you. It might be the right treatment for someone else.
Yeah, having that flexibility and having treatment options is so important for that reason, because so often either the client feels like the failure or the therapist is like, I'm the failure, maybe I messed that up. And yes, there's always room for improvement for us as treatment providers to hone in on our skills. Sometimes it's just not the right treatment for them. And so being able to be creative, or if ultimately you're like, hey, I've tried everything I know, than referring out to somebody that would have some other options, particularly, and people do not like starting over if they've built that trust with you. But if they trust you, then they generally, if you're like, but I trust this person and you deserve better than where we've been able to get to. I'm proud of you. I'm proud of the work we've done, but you need more support. And so I'm going to make sure that I don't hold you back on that.
And I'll often do a crossover in that kind of situation where at the beginning of the transition, I will attend, like, we do the sessions together. So it's like that gradual handover, which helps people to feel more comfortable. And I'll also do, like, a pretty solid handover of, like, history, what we've tried, all that kind of stuff. So, like, I don't have to go over all that again.
Right. Yes.
That doesn't always happen.
You were saying before, you have a let's not do this list. And could you share some of your tips for things not to do if your loved one is struggling with BDD?
It's kind of like, it's similar to any mental health condition. It's like not arguing with the person about the floor, like not minimizing their concern, but also not going like, no, that's not true. As people get into treatment, you can coach family members with the wording to use that may be how you're seeing it, that's not how I see it, and how can we reduce your distress, right? So working with that kind of approach rather than, no, that's not true, or no, you're not this thing, or you're not that thing, because that's really, that just shuts people down, right? And they don't have that safe place to be able to talk about their concern. And it would be similar to working with someone with OCD. So it's about not
accommodating, and
that's the word, or just trying to find it. Not accommodating the compulsion, but also not stopping it until the person's ready to do that. So they become part of the treatment rather than distinct from the treatment.
So they're walking along too. So that's you, fam. Uh-huh. Like if your loved one is going through this, you're walking through it too. It impacts you. And also realizing how, I know we say this in the OCD field as well, but if the person is having, you described earlier, like if I were to give myself this affirmation, then I kind of get in the debate. Well, if we get in the debate, whether it's in our own head or with our family members, then it has a similar effect of having that rumination. So even if the person is not having their own debate spirals about this, but if they're engaging in it with you, then they're still engaging in it. And so ultimately, when we think of something like ERP with the response prevention, we want to prevent that ruminating response, right? And so even helping people realize, like if the person is really focused on their nose not having the right shape, and you're like, you have a beautiful nose, then you're also kind of falling into the trap of trying to rationalize it. And so instead of engaging in that part of the conversation, but rather say, you know, even something to the effect of, I love you and I'm sorry you're having such a hard time right now. It still lets you be support without beating into the particular area where someone may be compulsing around that.
And it can also cause so much conflict, right? Like family, you end up, like the person might end up screaming at you, or like we escalate into next level kind of disagreements. And sometimes like in extreme circumstances, that can turn violent. So we want to try and prevent that at all costs. So just letting the person know, like, I'm here, I support you no matter what. It's okay. We're doing this together, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. And it can be challenging too, because again, you know, like you said, a lot of us don't have endless resources here to be able to just get by in life, let alone for a lot of folks that are struggling with BDD, kind of looking into different, whether it's skincare or hair care, or surgeries, et cetera, it gets to be very expensive. And so often they're going to need you to be able to help provide some resource, especially if you're in the family, right? You know, especially if you're a parent, say you have a teen that is dead set on getting a certain cream that costs $100 because they're pretty sure that that's the only thing that'll clear up their skin. You know, you don't want to just buy the cream, but also your loved one's probably going to get pretty fussy if you're like, no, I'm not buying this cream. And so people get into these conflicts. Even if they're trying not to get into the conflicts, they get into these conflicts. And so sometimes, like you're saying, having these online support groups or being able to reach out to your loved one's therapist, even, or maybe even getting your own therapist. I don't know how to talk to my loved one without getting into these conflicts, okay? And getting your own support so that you do have more bandwidth and ability to go and meet your loved one where they're at as you guys walk together this journey.
Yeah. And in that self-care, like making sure that the family members, because often when someone is very unwell in the family with any condition, then they become the center, right? And parents particularly, will let go of their own routine structure. And it's about how can you get balance between supporting the person that you care about while also taking care of yourself and having compassion when you fuck it up. Like, we all get it wrong, right? It doesn't mean that you're wrong or that you've failed. It means that you're human and you made a mistake, or the emotion took over or whatever, and that happens. And we all say things that we don't mean sometimes, and being able to go back and repair when it ends also, and acknowledge, like, that was not really helpful and I'm really sorry that happened.
Yeah. I mean, repairing is kind of a lost art in some respects, it feels like, in this day and age, but it makes such a profound difference. And so sometimes just even, again, if you need to reach out for your own support to be able to be like, how do I repair this? Particularly when you think of, and like you were talking about with the gender diverse population, there may already be a struggle to trust one another because of the circumstances, sometimes traumas. There's multifaceted variables that can go into that. And so what does it mean to have a repair there? And then add on with the mental health pieces, how do we work, especially if multiple people in the family maybe have some complex mental health presentations going on, because that is the world we live in. We all have physical health. We all have mental health. And so really being able to have your village, your loved one know that you're part of their village, for you to have your own support and your own self-care too, and go, okay, I don't need my person to be perfectly okay for me to be okay. I am a separate person and I can work on me, and then I can walk with them and we can work through this together too. And so There's lots of pieces to it, but it's all very, very important. It's too much. It's too much without those supports in place. Like, we need to find these resources, and not everyone is going to feel like they can go to their biological family, which is why we talk about chosen family a lot on this podcast too, because sometimes your chosen family isn't your blood family, but it is your village that have become your ride or dies, and those are the people that you can trust. And so have your people. There are supports online as well, and again, check out this episode's blog, because Sandy's sending me some amazing resources too that you guys can check out. But such great points. So as we wrap up on this note with the resources, what are some of the organizations and resources that you use with your clients or refer people to in terms of getting more support?
It sort of depends on the presentation. So with the gender dysphoria, that would be a different set of resources, right? I think that often the gender aspect is more difficult for a lot of parents to grasp. And particularly with our current political climate, there's a lot of fear. It is about finding your tribe, and that may not even be in your country, right? So being able to look outside your country, and one of the benefits, like we were talking about before, was like with COVID, we can access an international community in different ways than we ever could before. So just finding your tribe no matter where they are, and they might be spread across the whole world. So looking at that. But some of the places, there's an organization called the BDD Foundation, or Body Dysmorphic Disorder Foundation. They have some incredible resources. They also have lists of other resources. There are groups, support groups and therapeutic groups that are run through that foundation. They're www.bddfoundation.org. There's another one for particularly for family members, friends and loved ones. And that's feartocourage.com. They have some pretty incredible resources on there as well. The OCD Foundation has some stuff. OCDS.org. They've got some resources in there as well, and support groups that you can access. I'm not sure if they have one specific for BDD.
I think they have built out an arm of IOCDF to be focused on BDD. And they had, I want to say last year, they did their first online, or not last year, earlier this year. Oh my gosh. The time is flying, though. I can't keep the calendar. But I want to say maybe it was like February or something. Earlier this year, they had a 1-day online virtual training for BDD as well, which is a fantastic, much needed resource, because like you said, if you need to be able to access this from anywhere in the world, and especially if it's a training where you can go back and watch trainings that are stored within that conference offering, that is a huge, huge strength. It doesn't always address the cultural pieces that we need to see. Like you said, English isn't the first language for everyone. And sometimes even how things are conceptualized are based on more Western culture. And so a tool is better than no tool. But sometimes our tools really need to be modified to really reflect and better represent the different cultures around the world, because mental health does not discriminate. BDD does not discriminate. OCD does not discriminate. Eating disorders does not discriminate.
Well, that's the piece where, like, take what you need and leave behind what is irrelevant. All of this goes for everyone. If you find something helpful, then take it with you. If it's not helpful, just leave it.
Yeah. Be flexible. Don't get so zoomed into this should work that you miss you. It's a really important, very important piece. I'm excited to, you said feartocourage.com. I'm excited to check that out. Family, a full website just for us. I love it. And so we'll definitely have to check that out. Well, Sandy, this has been so helpful and fantastic, but just wanted to give you a chance if there's anything else.
The only thing that I always say, like, just find your tribe. And if that's online, that's okay. It doesn't have to be an in-person tribe, because some pockets of the world and country, there isn't access to things that can be helpful. And don't give up. Like, there is, you can recover and you can find treatment that is effective. And if you can't, if the first place doesn't work, then pack up and find someone else. So,
right.
Yeah, just don't give up.
When I was going through the Behavioral Therapy Training Institute for OCD, otherwise known as the BTTI, my group leader was Dr. Eric Storch, and he would say, having a therapist is kind of like dating. If you didn't have the right one, you didn't have the right one. Keep going. If you've got a goal in mind, don't give up on the goal just because you ended up with a wrong fit or it didn't quite take you where you needed to be. And so I think it's a really good reminder that there's always hope out there. And I have to say, you know, we talked a little bit about this last week. I was talking with Dr. Nick Neve about hoarding, and the Gen Z population, I am here for it. They are breaking stigma left and right. They are getting on. They're talking about it. And what you do find online or on Reddit or on social media, you got to take with a little bit of a grain of salt sometimes. But it is so, so helpful for knowing you're not alone. And sometimes you get real treasures there as well. And so being able to have those kind of resources, and like you said, Sandy, if it's not in your country of origin, okay. Take what is helpful. If it's helpful, it's helpful, period. Right?
Yeah. And check the facts. Like with yes. TikTok and stuff, always check before you get fucked into that, because often there's a lot of shit out there.
Yes, there's plenty of shit out
there.
It's
terrifying as well.
Yes. Like I said, some of it you got to take with a grain of salt. But you're right. You're right. Check your facts, but also let the message, the encouraging piece be that you're not alone and people are having these conversations, even if they don't always get it right. So let it help you be curious to learn more and know that there are resources out there that can provide hope. Well, Sandy, y'all, she got up at 4 a.m. I said Sandy wins. Sandy wins the award of like most amazing guest time. Holy cow. And so thank you so much for spending time with us today, for sharing the resources with the fam, and for bringing more hope to BDD warriors, as it's such a complicated and cruel disorder, but we know that there is hope out there, and there's life and there's freedom, and you can live a life that isn't dictated by BDD. So that is a beautiful thing.
Yeah, just keep going. Just keep going. This has been awesome. It's been a pleasure chatting with you, and foreign's perfectly fine in for my interesting little brain that lives in my head.
Well, I appreciate it. We appreciate it. And you see, Sandy was like, I will meet you at 4, fam. I will do it for the fam. So we thank you. Yeah. This has been great.
100%.
Intrusive thoughts. Okay, fam. Alrighty. What an important conversation. And like we mentioned there in the middle, it can feel really heavy, but ending on those hopeful notes are so important. So I'm really glad we could raise awareness, understanding, and compassion for the challenges, but also end on the note regarding the hope and the supports for our BDD warriors and loved ones. So again, Sandy, especially since you showed up at 4 a.m., fam, I don't even show up at 4 a.m. for myself. So that's really incredible. But she graciously offered me that time. We made it work. And I just want to thank you again, Sandy, for sharing with the OCD family community. Also, I wanted to note that the BDD Foundation, which Sandy mentioned is one of the fantastic resources that will be linked over on this episode's blog, has recently shared about some newer BDD research on the connection between shame, trauma, and more when it comes to BDD. So I reached out immediately to those researchers, and we're actually already collaborating on an episode for the new year, fam. So I am excited because we'll get to bring more BDD hope, information, and understanding for warriors and families. And this brings us then to my intrusive thought segment, which is my application segment of the show for any newer family joining. And it's that part of the show where we try and think of what we heard and how we can apply it. So first things first, fam, I want to challenge want you to think about something you learned during this episode, and I'm going to challenge you to either write it down or share it with a trusted confidant, be it a bestie or a spouse, but list at least one thing that was new information for you, or even share this episode with them and say, hey, listen to this, and then let's chat about it. For example, I learned that it's really, really difficult to distinguish between BDD and gender dysphoria when going through a transition process. And I know surgeries and even hormone replacement therapies, they bring up a lot of big feelings for people. Again, I'll challenge us to be curious beyond the feelings and say, let's look at how BDD opportunistically can flare in this scenario. My heart just breaks for anyone that goes through a procedure only to find BDD screaming at them from the other side. I can't imagine. And I wish there was a better way to know beforehand. Sandy said it's possible, but it's really, really tricky. Nearly impossible. So what do we do with that, fam? Well, it takes research. Research takes more learning, and learning takes the ability to have some conversations and develop better understandings. So if you've made it this far into the pod with us, thank you. Thank you for being a part of the conversation. And then lastly, it's been a hot minute since we've done a village welfare check, if you will. We are all in our own trenches, whether it's because of BDD or OCD or anything else. Life is messy and it is hard. But family, we're not in these trenches alone. So look around. Let's do a roll call. And you know what? If you're like, but Nicole, I don't have anyone here with me. Then check out the BDD Foundation or IOCDF.org for a support group. Heck, get on TikTok or Insta and keyword search the thing that's been plaguing you, because I promise you, fam, there is a village. There is. And you matter. You belong. So look around, see who's here, and thank you for being a part of our OCD family village, because we are better together. Thank you for joining me and our OCD family community. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please like and subscribe to the OCD Family Podcast wherever you enjoy your podcasts. Did you find this content helpful? Please consider leaving a review. The more people that know they're not alone, the better. For more information regarding today's podcast, please visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com and remember to join the email list while you're there. It will provide you with the most up-to-date information, resources, and the download on the family chatter. Oh yeah, nothing says family like Sandy and me supporting our BDD family. That's right. I went there. And you can too at OCDFamilyPodcast.com. Okay, clinicians, are you ready to transform your practice? Then mark your calendars for February 6th and 7th of 2025, because Dr. Pia Callison is presenting a two-day live virtual training on metacognitive therapy through OCD Training School. Metacognitive therapy explores the process of how we think about our thoughts, and it has shown to be helpful in treating OCD, depression, anxiety, and PTSD. Sign up today through my link at OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses to support the podcast at no extra cost to you. So what are you waiting for? This transdiagnostic approach is ready to take your practice to the next level at OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses.